The matter of Malik Kennedy versus Commonwealth. And Mr. Morse, we got your message on that. I don't have my materials for that case handy, but next time we take a break, we'll be happy to take that up. We'll do it so we're not keeping you around all day.
And I do apologize.
Well, I'll tell you what. Fortunately, my colleague does have them, and I will share off of his. So when we complete this argument, we'll go ahead and take your writ argument.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Have you signed in?
I did.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Thank you. Come on up.
All right.
Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Sure, I'll take 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. You may begin when you're ready.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Morris, before you start, yes. I believe the clerk sent a letter to both of y'all asking that you be prepared to argue whether reliability is an issue and whether Henderson controls.
Yes.
And whether or not due process was argued below.
Yes.
Okay. Now, having said that, I'd like for you to address that at whatever point you think is appropriate. But my first question is, didn't he plead guilty to violating the conditions of the probation?
He did, Your Honor.
All right. If that's the case, then how can he argue hearsay issues?
Yes, sir.
Because when you plead guilty, you waive everything, including constitutional arguments.
Yes, sir. How the case progressed was he did enter a plea of guilty. He did take the stand in his own defense. During his testimony, it became apparent, I think to the trial judge, because there were comments made on the record regarding that, that my client had admitted to writing one letter to his biological cousin. The court then sought to clarify whether it was just one letter or multiple letters. And at that point, my client denied writing several letters to alleged gang members. And at that point, from our perspective, the court then changed the nature of the proceeding instead to my client contesting the nature of that one violation. And so that is when the Commonwealth then called their witness, who was the probation officer, who then testified over defense objection about the email that she received in which it was alleged that my client had authored letters to several gang members, not just his one biological cousin.
I understand the posture of this case, but I still don't understand how you can argue hearsay on a plea of guilty.
Well, from our perspective, Judge, in essence, the plea at that point changed. In which my client was then contesting the evidence.
Show me in the record where he withdrew the plea of guilty.
Well, he didn't formally withdraw the plea, Your Honor. We certainly concede that. However, he was contesting the facts that the Commonwealth was alleging in his violation. Instead of just one person that he acknowledged writing to, which was his cousin, he denied writing to the other individuals, at which point that officer testified to the email, which we considered hearsay at that point.
All right, so thank you.
And then going to the other issues that you brought up, Your Honor, the right of confrontation, we argue, was preserved when we did object to the hearsay testimony coming in. I believe I even asked the question of the court, wouldn't we need the gang intelligence officer here? I perhaps didn't preserve that as artfully as I should have in hindsight. However, I would still argue that would be sufficient to preserve that confrontation argument by bringing up the fact that, one, hearsay was objected to, and then, two, questioning regarding whether that officer should have been present in court. Hearsay, by its very nature, is a confrontation issue where you are arguing that you don't...
Only if you raise it.
Well, we did object to the hearsay testimony coming in, so that is raising that issue at that point, Your Honor. The second issue, I believe, that was mentioned was whether Hernandez applied, and it is our contention that it does. That case is on point, from my understanding, about testimonial hearsay being allowed in probation violation cases. It's the only case that I did cite in this matter, we do believe that Henderson still applies, that the Commonwealth did not meet its burden that was delineated in Henderson about the trustworthiness of the information. The Commonwealth essentially didn't submit any evidence backing up the reliability of that email. The probation officer had not spoken to anyone about it, had not confirmed through my client whether he in fact wrote any of these other letters that were alleged to have been written. The probation officer was not familiar with his handwriting. Essentially, the probation officer was just allowed to read an email written by someone else, and that was then taken as evidence on this particular condition of his probation. And so we did object to that in a timely fashion. And I argue that Henderson does apply, which does not support the Commonwealth's use of that hearsay information in this violation case.
Mr. Morris, help me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What about the notation of his telephone number on the second email?
The notation of his telephone
number? Acknowledging or the appellant responding to the email by providing a telephone number that he could be reached. Would that affect the reliability at all?
I suppose the suggestion is that the telephone number is an accurate number that belongs to my client.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was no evidence of that. My client was never questioned about that, never acknowledged that that was in fact his telephone number. And so I think if that had happened, then yes, you might have had some other corroborating evidence to back up that particular hearsay item, but that was never questioned at the hearing.
Hey, help me out with something, if you will, and maybe I'm oversimplifying this a little bit, but this kind of follows on your interplay with Judge Frank. Your client pleaded guilty, stipulated the violation in this case, which means obviously he stipulated there was good cause to revoke the terms of his suspended sentence. So that makes this issue with the hearsay potentially a sentencing issue. It's as to what occurs with the violation, not whether or not he violated it, because he's already stipulated that. Now, if the judge is entrusted with broad discretion upon the finding of good cause to revoke a suspended sentence, he can give as much or as little as he chooses as long as it falls within the range of what remains suspended. How is this an abuse of discretion? Because isn't that what we kind of fall to on this?
Well, if you do fall to that, then I would bring up that the trial court made specific mention that the other violations, which was a travel outside his permitted zone and a failure to pay restitution, I believe the trial judge addressed those two technical violations as not being serious. And as a matter of fact, said he wouldn't have given him any more time had it been just those violations. And it was the contact with the alleged gang members that the court mentioned was really the serious violation, and that is why he received the time that he did. So I would argue that it was not just a harmless error by the court, but in fact caused him to receive more time than he should have.
But doesn't our existing law essentially say that the only way a judge abuses his discretion is, number one, if there's not good cause to revoke the suspended sentence and we don't have to worry about that, or he or she gives the defendant more time than otherwise permitted by law to do? That is, it revokes 7 years when they're only 5 years suspended.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is correct. That is correct. I don't argue that point.
How do we get to an abuse of discretion here if the law says that giving him what time he's got is not an abuse of discretion?
Well, under that scenario, Your Honor, like I mentioned, with the trial court specifically stating that because of the serious nature of the gang communication, that is where the time that he imposed came from, then I would argue that my client was harmed. It was an abuse of discretion by admitting hearsay information that should not have been admitted that caused the sentence to be harsher than the trial court would have otherwise given. And on the record, he stated that he wouldn't have given him any more time had it been just those two other technical violations. So that is where I argue that had that information not been admitted by the court, my client would not have received the sentence that he did.
Yes, sir. Thank you. You've still got some time before you get to your rebuttal time. Not saying that you have to use it,
no,
but it's there if you want
to. I think I'll defer to the Commonwealth at this
okay,
point.
Okay, we'll keep that aside for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Mr. Morris. Good morning, Ms. Tyson.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. With regard to whether this issue was preserved at trial and on appeal, the defendant didn't preserve it. He didn't argue due process. He didn't argue Henderson. He didn't argue 14th Amendment due process. And we all know, even from the opinion from the Supreme Court from last Thursday, that you can't sneak a constitutional issue in when you don't raise it. However, in this case, the trial court, and it's not completely clear, but it seemed the trial court understood that he was making an argument based on Henderson. And I say that because when he...
While maybe they didn't mention the case, everybody, including the common attorney, argued reliability.
Correct. That is correct.
In fact, that's what the briefs were all about before this court.
That's correct.
And including from the attorney general's office.
Yes, sir. It is. And the trial judge, it started when the prosecutor, there was an objection. Well, this is hearsay. This can't come in. The prosecutor said, well, hearsay can come in at a probation revocation. And the court said, reliable hearsay can come in at a revocation hearing. And that's about on page 36 of the appendix. Later, and this is on page 41, the court says, per case law, the court can consider substantive hearsay in a violation proceeding if it's of a kind to be considered reliable. And, of course, that is essentially the holding of Henderson, which addresses...
But it's premised on due process, right of confrontation,
yes,
isn't it?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. And so, although it is not crystal clear, it does seem that the trial judge understood that was the argument that was being raised and took great pains to say why this was reliable. Of course, the trial court also had an additional reason why he felt it was admissible to rebut the testimony of the defendant. And so I'm aware that this court has applied 518. I'm aware of the Anderson unpublished opinion where it's very, very close to this case as far as what was argued at trial and even what the assignment of error was on appeal. The difference was, and I thought about, for instance, Hernandez versus New York, the case where if the prosecutor gives the reasons for the Batson challenge, then the prima facie issue sort of becomes moot, and we don't address that because we got past it. Or Scaldone in the versus Commonwealth of Virginia Supreme Court. If the trial court rules on it, then even though it may not have been presented properly to the trial court, the merits are addressed. There are a number of ways to address the merits in this case, with waiver, with just the merits, with the unobjected to evidence, and so that is the way that we responded to the argument. Is Henderson controlling? This is not exactly Henderson, because, and we argue this, page 10 of our brief, because in Henderson, of course, the hearsay evidence went to, was there a violation? And that's not what any hearsay evidence was used for in this case. In this case, the defendant acknowledged the violation. And I must confess, and maybe this is a holdover from my trial prosecutor days, but it seemed to me that when you come to a probation violation, it's not that you are pleading guilty. You are acknowledging that there's been a violation. You've already had your trial. You've already been convicted of the crime. And now it's, is there good cause to revoke some of the grace that the trial court has extended to you from this case that you've already pled? And so in this case, we do have the defendant acknowledging that he was in violation of probation. And even after he testified that he only wrote one letter to his cousin who was a gang member, he acknowledged that it was a total ban. That one letter to his cousin gang member would have been sufficient. Now, when we look, though, we did rely on Henderson. We did use that as a template for the argument, even though this really is, as Judge Attlee said better than I did in my brief, this is really a sentencing issue because of the fact that there was an admission that there was a probation violation. So the Commonwealth was not relying on any hearsay to prove the violation, only as to sentencing. And yes, the court did consider the numerous letters to the gang members in fashioning the remedy. But let's look at what really happened here at this revocation hearing.
Well, let me interrupt you so that I'm clear.
Yes.
You don't think that by pleading guilty that he waived this issue?
I think that he waived the issue in other ways. I think he...
No, but simply
what is this, a Peyton versus King, Savino versus Commonwealth kind of situation? I don't think that it's a straight guilty plea as it is in a criminal charge. He did waive it. He acknowledged that he had violated the terms of probation. He also did not object to the introduction of the addendum. And the introduction, the addendum itself said that he had written several letters to different gang members. So that evidence is before the trial court, before any testimony is given by anyone. And the court actually observed. This addendum came in unobjected to. On page 8 is that addendum, which recites that it's from a gang intelligence officer and that the defendant contacted several gang members. So the fact is before the trial court, before anybody ever testifies at this probation violation hearing. So the defendant testifies at his hearing, and he attempts to minimize what he did, although he's already admitted that he's in violation of probation. He's violated his probation. He attempted to minimize those violations, but he does concede that he was in violation of probation.
But the trial judge, in determining the amount of time to be revoked, focused on the
yes.
email about what happened up in the New York penitentiary.
Yes.
So he got hit heavy because of what was in the email.
Yes, he did. That was already admitted without his objection before anybody ever testified. And
now, help me with that.
Yes.
That wasn't my recollection.
Okay. Page 8 of the appendix has the addendum from the probation officer. And that notes that she has information from Officer Royster from Greensville stating that the defendant, they had intercepted letters. Mr. Kennedy was contacting several gang members by regular mail and J-Pay. Okay. Then, at the hearing, page 21 of the appendix, Your Honor, the court notes, I'll mark the violation report and addendum filed and make it part of the record in the proceeding. Does the Commonwealth have additional evidence? So there it is. There's no objection. This addendum is part of the record. I'll mark the violation filed and make it part of the record in this proceeding. And so then
The addendum doesn't talk about the New York, the violence generated in New York or anything like that.
It does mention that there were several letters to
right.
various gang members through regular mail and J-Pay, which I think involves supplying money. Page 36 of the appendix, when there is argument with regard to this, the court says, at the top of the page, the court is saying, you know, hearsay would also be admissible to rebut something. So the report came in without objection that alleged several gang members. So that's in contradiction to the defendant's testimony that I just wrote this one letter to my cousin who happens to be a gang member. So before he ever testifies, the evidence is before the court. The court notes was unobjected to that he had been in contact with several gang members. So then if we also look at what happened in this case with regard to whether the evidence was reliable that Ms. Issa provided for them. I think the Saunders case is most instructive, and we cited that in our brief, that this is information from one government agent, one government official to another with regard to the evidence about the contact with gang members. Now, the other, of course, really interesting fact in this case is that the trial court offered the defense the opportunity to look at these letters. He said, in fairness, was the word that the trial court used. In fairness, I'll let you look at these letters so you can rebut them and tell me that you didn't write them. And the response from counsel was, we want to finish our trial today. We'll deal with this. He'll deal with this in allocution.
He
did not. He only apologized in allocution. He did not dispute that he had written the letters, did not take the court's offer to look at those letters and to make any, to refute anything for them. So there's really one layer after another in this proceeding of why the trial court's decision in this case is not erroneous. The fact that the information about several gang members is already before the court, the fact that this is government agents who are providing information to one another, the fact that he's admitted part of the contact with gang members to start with, and then does not take the offer from the trial court to refute the reliability of this information from the gang intelligence officer. So for all of those reasons, the trial court did not err in this case. And the trial court did not abuse its discretion in determining the appropriate sentence after the defendant had acknowledged that he was in violation of the terms of his probation. And for all of those reasons and the reasons that we argued in our brief, we would urge the court to affirm. But I am, of course, happy to answer any other questions the court may have.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Morse?
I would just raise just one issue. And believe when the court allowed my client to address the letters, there was never any indication that those letters were actually present in court for him to review. It was only the email that was presented. The probation officer specifically stated that she had nothing else, and that it was only that email. So he was not given the opportunity to see the original letters, as the Commonwealth had suggested. Also, going back to the other issue of whether it was waived by the guilty plea, I think how this came out is that while my client testified, it was clear that he was contesting that he had written these other letters. He was certainly conceding that he wrote the one, but once the trial court picked up on the fact that my client was denying writing these other letters, that changed the trajectory of this case, and that is why I'm arguing that even though there was an initial plea that he did violate his probation by writing a letter, the fact that he denied writing the other letters, which, as we hear later on, caused some problems in another state, and that information was then used to heighten his sentence or make it more serious, that is when we are arguing that that information should not have been allowed, because it was hearsay, it was inadmissible, it does not comport with what Henderson allows, and so we are arguing that the trial judge should not have even considered those other letters as being authored by my client.
Thank you very much. We'll come down to Greek Council, then we'll take care of your writ.